Hi folks, my name is Walker. I'm from the University of Minnesota. I work for the central IT unit there conducting research and evaluation on educational technologies. I'm here with my colleague Christopher Brooks, who works for ECAR, also conducting research on educational technologies. And we're here today to discuss with you some of the findings from an ongoing research project having to do with MOOCs implemented at the University of Minnesota. There is no reason for that slide except just that I thought it was kind of cool. So anyway, there it is. The agenda for today's talk is really that we examined the first five MOOCs that we taught at the University of Minnesota last summer. What we're going to touch on today really are matters of the amount of time and effort that went into creating the MOOCs on the part of faculty and TAs, an analysis of the student population that took the MOOCs, and then a predictive analysis of a couple of different kinds of outcomes. Completion of MOOCs defined in different ways, and also student performance in the MOOCs. That's the overall agenda. It's kind of a data-heavy presentation, so we have space at the end for questions, but I want to encourage you along the way, if there's anything that needs clarification, if you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand and interrupt us. We are broadcasting online, so if you have a question, then we'll ask you to use one of the microphones at the center of the room. So that's what we are going to do today. We offered five MOOCs in summer 2013. You can see the subject matter for each of them right there. They're all more or less, broadly speaking, in the sciences, from veterinary medicine through an advanced chemistry course. The total nominal enrollment was over 70,000. That's the number people like to bandy about. It represents people who clicked a button in the Coursera website without any particular level of commitment. And one thing that we'd like to start off by saying, and this is something that that you may be familiar with. Hit escape there, thanks. We discovered that conducting research on MOOCs is difficult. It's difficult for a number of reasons. Well, one is that you do have a lot of students with a low level of commitment. And that means it's difficult to get them to do things, like fill out assessments, write assignments, you know, and respond to your surveys, that sort of thing, because they just don't have the level of commitment. They have no skin in the game. The population taking MOOCs is different than the population taking courses at our campus, maybe more similar to online universities, very different from the students that we deal with. And that means that we don't really know what is going to help them to learn, what's going to hinder them from learning. Right? So the predictors of their success may be different from the predictors that we're familiar with. Finally, we don't know who they are. Right? There's a bunch of students that arrive and we don't know what their background is unless we ask them and they respond. We don't know what their aptitude for the course material is. We don't know how much they know in advance. So that makes it very difficult to conduct a valid analysis of how much they've learned in a MOOC. So now that I've set the expectations very low, I'm going to hand it over to Christopher Brooks, who's going to tell you how we overcame these limitations.
Thanks, Walker. I like the low expectations because then we can exceed them. They look really good. So very briefly, MOOCs themselves, there's not a lot of research out there on them per se, and so we're kind of really starting from scratch trying to understand what these phenomena are. And what Walker and I did from the very beginning was to rely upon what we knew from the literature about online learning, about learning in general, about educational technology, in order to think about the kinds of data and information that might be useful to us in thinking about them. Plus, we also needed to look at some institutional data as well to sort of validate or to at least give feedback on the MOOC initiative that we had going. And so that kind of leads into sort of the first one, tracking time and effort. We did this with the instructors who were teaching each of the respective courses, as well as tracking OIT effort in terms of the production side of the MOOCs on the front end. For student characteristics, again, we don't have access to institutional research on people that are taking these courses because they're coming from all over the world and may not be attached to an institution at all. And so we really had to start from scratch with the kinds of things that we might collect from them, such as demographic variables, their reasons or motivation for taking MOOCs, prior experience with MOOCs, how many they're taking now, the amount of time that they might have available to research or to play with the course. And then we also looked at later on obstacles that they might have in terms of actually completing, so on the back end of the post-test that we were performing. So basically we're doing a shotgun approach because we didn't know which factors might play out, but we're doing it in a way that was thoughtful and theoretically informed. And lastly, we needed to plan about looking at student outcomes on the back end, which is one of the more difficult aspects. And for that, we looked at student intent from the pretest data, and also on the post survey that we conducted, we asked them about how much they completed versus how much they intended to complete. We also, of course, had the basic sort of course data in terms of grades, the amount completed, and that sort of thing. And we actually had a couple of instructors that were sort of thoughtful enough in advance to develop a couple of pre- and post-test instruments that were related to the actual content of the course so that they could track learning gains that way. In terms of the data sources, we used basically sort of traditional methods and approaches there. The time and effort diaries was something that we pushed out to the faculty and TAs on a weekly basis so that we could track what they were doing across the variety of tasks associated with producing and then eventually executing the MOOCs. We conducted in-depth, semi-structured faculty interviews with them so that we were asking the same questions across, but also allowed for plenty of room for their own sort of personal touch and for them to reflect individually that way. Pre- and post-surveys, that sort of speaks for itself. The one caveat that we would point out here is that post-surveys went out only to students who completed a baseline survey for us on the pretest, and that way we were saving a lot of effort and time and expense in trying to collect that data. But what we really needed here was pre- and post-test data so that we could match that up and sort of look at the longitudinal effects there. And lastly, we did peek at the Coursera data. We found it to be a little unwieldy in terms of our ability to manage it. You have to run these really complex queries in order to extract the data. And even when we were able to do that, we weren't finding that there was necessarily that much that really matched up with our theoretical questions. So, but we did add that into the hopper. So the first things that I'm going to talk about with you here are the self-reported hours, and then I'm going to talk about sort of the reflections from the faculty. So on your left here, you have the five MOOCs listed in the columns representing each course. And then we also have some unidentified hours that were unaccounted for, as well as the TAs associated with those courses. We broke it out into a planning phase and as well as an executing phase because the MOOCs were not going on simultaneously. They were kind of staggered, so we wanted to be able to catch that data across. On the planning side, it was everything from individuals reading about MOOCs, trying to learn what MOOCs are and what the phenomenon was, to doing course design, instructional design, content creation, both written as well as high-end media production, written assignments, and so forth. For the execution side, it was mostly monitoring, also sort of ad hoc planning that might go on based on what they were getting out of the course or problems that they might be having, as well as doing assessment and evaluation of the students on the backside. So in terms of hours, we got this is what we ended up with. And you can see there that it's a considerable amount of effort that faculty had to put into planning their MOOC. On average, 222 and a half hours. And if we break that down into kind of a 40-hour work week, we're basically talking about 5.5 weeks worth, 5.5 weeks worth of FTE dedicated to producing those. There is considerable variation within the amount of planning that occurred. So you can see there on the upper end, we have the sustainability and food systems, as well as the healthcare informatics. But on the lower end, we have the canine theragenology course, where we only had about 20 hours expended on that. And the reason behind this was that the instructor who taught this, Peggy Groot, had been teaching this course online for a considerable period of time. And so most of her effort on the planning stage was simply migrating her content over to the Coursera platform. So we get considerable variation in there, but still pretty high averages overall when we are looking at this. In terms of execution, also fairly high hours, but considerable variation in there as well. The bottom three of the courses, healthcare informatics, epidemiology, and theragenology courses, are all kind of in the same family, less than 100, a little bit more than 50. But the two on the top, the thermodynamics and the food systems, those were cases in which the instructors, Chris Kramer and Jason Hill, respectively, were really sort of deeply engaged with their courses. They were going into the fora and engaging in conversations with students and really sort of monitoring it throughout. So this really sort of reflects the amount of effort that they were putting in it themselves. The TAs took care of a lot of the day-to-day business on the MOOCs at large. So when we look at the total of these things, a lot of time and effort was put in by the five faculty and the respective four TAs in producing these MOOCs. 380 hours, roughly, is that 9.5 weeks of 40-hour work weeks being expended to produce these things. And when you think about the cost, and we have tenured faculty doing this at a Research One institution, salaries and so forth, you can see that they can be quite expensive. On the side of bringing the staff hours into it, we had 1,705 staff hours within OIT that was dedicated to the production of MOOCs. And this included everything from our hours of doing research and evaluation to people doing planning and working on instructional design, as well as doing the recording and production value on the backside. So when we add all of this up, there were 3,605 hours total expended on producing Minnesota's first five MOOCs, which comes out to roughly an average of 90 weeks of work total to produce these five courses, and that includes the faculty side as well. We also, from our interviews with the faculty, we garnered considerable insight into their experiences. Overall, they had a very positive perspective about their experiences, both in the production as well as in the teaching of the MOOCs. Their personal and professional satisfaction, they all rated this as something very high for them and very important for them, as well as the personal and professional connections that they were made, especially with the broad reach that they were having globally. And it was that global reach that really was something that they all kept on coming back to and hitting upon repeatedly. Emphasizing the fact that normally they would only hit just a handful of students in their face-to-face classes, and now they were literally dealing with thousands of people all over the world. Perhaps I think the most important thing out of their overall thing was how MOOCs really served to get them to think about teaching again. So here we have something where really it's the technology is helping to serve as a lever or as a catalyst to get people to rethink how they have been teaching and to sort of keep things fresh going forward. And I'll mention a little bit about that in another slide. Getting them to reflect on what MOOCs are and what the ideas are surrounding them were. These were the five main things that kept on sort of popping up. I think at least three individuals probably said each of these things in some form or fashion, the most interesting of which is perhaps the edutainment one, that they were really self-aware of the fact that they were performing and they were broadcasting to a large audience who was simply there to really consume. And so being aware of that, I think, was sort of healthy for them to understand that. In terms of thinking beyond the MOOC, this goes back to what I said about using the MOOC as a lever to think about teaching. A lot of them realized the importance of a brief lecture as opposed to walking in and lecturing for 55 minutes or 75 minutes, depending upon their courses, and was really sort of forcing them to rethink what they needed to do. So focusing on small lectures, turning this back out into a more student-centered approach with more active learning, more discussion, a more constructivist approach. And also not being so narrow in terms of how they were teaching the specific courses they were teaching, but plugging it into the larger context of the major as well as the field beyond the boundaries of the university itself. And so sort of thinking about the big idea, the big picture here, was something that they all seemed to garner from that. There was some concern about how their efforts put into this might be evaluated in the long term. Not for any of them specifically, because they were all tenured professors and so forth, but they realized that, you know, that this isn't any of this doesn't really represent any of the traditional forms of academic engagement that we might normally see. And so how might it be evaluated, and what might peer review look like for this? And that, for them, I think, raised questions for other people, especially junior faculty, that might be interested in teaching the MOOCs and expending so much energy in doing this when they could or should be perhaps dedicating themselves to face-to-face learning or to publishing and other efforts. And the last thing that I'll say about the faculty experience is that while most of them, well, really all of them really enjoyed the international component of it and interacting with people from all over the world, they did point out that there was on occasion some friction or some tension between people from around the world based on cultural differences and cultural perspectives on what it was that they were teaching, different methodologies that might be attached to the respective fields, but focus, you know, coming out of a literature from different parts of the world, and also from different standards that might be expected in terms of research and teaching as well. But I think what they walked away from, what was a better understanding of themselves and sort of the echo chamber of the American Academy and working with American higher ed, and the need to sort of reflect on why it is that they do the things that they do, and then to be able to articulate that back out to the larger population. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Walker, who's going to go into a little bit more of the heavy data side of things.
So that's about the end of what we have to say about the faculty. Who are teaching our MOOCs, the effects on the faculty and the effort that they expended. Maybe we can stop right now just to see if there's a question or two about the faculty experience or anything that's gone on so far. Yeah, please, I'm going to give you a microphone to our online audience. Please come up.
Yes, I'm just curious, because you said you had online classes, what was the comparison for their first initial online class compared to the effort they had to put into a MOOC?
In terms of the amount of effort they expended to produce the first online course?
Yes.
That I'm not really sure. I don't have any information on.
I would guess it's similar, but that's a guess.
It might very well be. And this is one thing that Walker and I were talking about yesterday, that one thing that you might see reflected in that is that there's a huge startup cost for producing the first one, and if it's offered again subsequently, it's very likely that we wouldn't see as much effort going into the planning, other than maybe tweaking things and revising things or adding new content and taking some things out. So I think that's insightful.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think this is pretty conspicuous. If you look on the right-hand column, right, well, what's the outlier there? Right, the outlier is canine theriogenology. It says 72 total hours for planning and executing, right? So, I mean, I think that speaks to the investment of effort in the online course, which then pays dividends in the MOOC version.
How long are your MOOCs, or how long are the courses?
They varied in length. I want to say about 5 weeks on average, something like that.
I think like 4 or 5 was the lowest end, and maybe it went up to 8 or something like that with Chris Kramer's.
Yeah, so there was variability. And maybe we can take one more question before we move on.
How are the particular faculty and courses selected for the partnership with Coursera? Do they sort of volunteer into this?
Volunteering, I think. They didn't have any incentive as such beyond the assistance that we provided them in terms of video production and faculty development efforts to adapt the courses to the online environment. I think that was basically it, right?
I think there was a call for proposals, and maybe there were some additional ones that didn't make the first cut, or at least that's my understanding of how at least the second round has occurred.
So we did have some demand on the faculty side, and we could kind of select the faculty. So I'm going to hold the rest of the questions just for now so we can proceed on, because we have a lot of tables full of obscure numbers we really want to show you. So. This is not one of them. This is the beginning of our analysis of the student population. So as I mentioned before, one interesting thing about MOOCs is that it reaches a very different student population from your normal face-to-face course. And what we wanted to do was understand that student population. One important dimension of that understanding is their reasons for taking a MOOC in the first place, or their motivations. And we wanted to investigate this because we feel like with our face-to-face students, for most of them, they have a pretty good understanding of what their motivations are, right? For taking a course. Combination of interest plus wanting course credit and progress towards a degree, right? But we don't know that about MOOC students. We know it's a very different population. So we asked on our pre-survey a dozen individual questions about motivations, which you can see on the left in illegibly small font. So they're things like, this subject matter is relevant to my academic field of study, this class teaches skills that will help my job and career, because this course is offered by a prestigious university, that sort of thing. We then conducted a principal components analysis on the data that we got on each of these questions. And we extracted 4 factors from that analysis, all of which had eigenvalues greater than 1. The 4 factors together explained almost 65% of the variance in the data. And each of the questions loaded onto exactly 1 of the factors with pretty good loadings of about 0.75, 0.8 or above. If you know anything about factor analysis, that's not bad for a first cut. So we were pretty happy about that. And we felt we could then go on and use those aggregated dimensions, the 4 dimensions represented in the circles on the right, as components in our analysis. So as predictive variables, trying to understand outcomes in terms of these aggregated dimensions, and also as dependent variables, if we try to understand what makes a student's professional type reasons stronger for taking a MOOC. So the aggregate dimensions really are university-related reasons would have to do with the school, in this case Minnesota, offering the MOOC, the professor offering the MOOC. Access-related reasons, which are things like, I'm not close to a physical university, or regular courses are too expensive, that sort of thing. Professional reasons would have to do with furthering a person's career, and then just reasons of interest and enjoyment. So those are the basic dimensions there. If we just look at overall mean scores for those four different dimensions, as you can see, enjoyment type reasons are by far the strongest ones across the whole population, which is no surprise. Pretty much everybody is motivated by enjoyment or interest. Some people are motivated by other sorts of reasons. If we look a little more deeply into the data, though, we start to see associations between the different types of reasons for taking a MOOC and other features of students. So this graph shows the association between a student's self-reported English proficiency and the 4 aggregated dimensions of motivation for taking a MOOC. And one thing you can see here, should be pretty obvious, is that as a student's self-reported English proficiency goes up, as they become a better speaker of English, their enjoyment type reasons for taking a MOOC become stronger. But all 3 other categories of reason for taking a MOOC decline in strength. Right? So their professional, access-related, and university or faculty-related reasons become weaker the better they speak English. If we look at another variable, we can see a very similar pattern. One thing that we asked students was how much of the MOOC they completed relative to their relative to their intentions and expectations when they went into the course. And Christopher is going to have more to say about different measures of completion in a MOOC later on. But you should see a similar pattern here, right? The three categories of motivation for taking a MOOC, access-related, university-related, and professional reasons, track together. And basically, the more of a MOOC a student completed, the stronger all three of those reasons were, and slightly weaker were the enjoyment-related reasons. So similar pattern. Those three types of reasons tracking together, one type of reason is an outlier. We think that really what's going on here is that student motivations for taking a MOOC divide the MOOC population. We see these relationships across many variables in our survey. So what this graph is showing you here is that students who live outside the U.S., who are not native English speakers, who are in a related field to the subject matter of the MOOC, either professionally or academically, who are graduate students and who are male, students with those characteristics have stronger professional access-related and university-related reasons for taking a MOOC, and they have weaker enjoyment-related reasons for taking a MOOC. What's really happening here, we think, is that there are basically two different populations of students that took our MOOCs. And I just put these kind of jokey names up there for lack of a better word. But we have one population who live outside the U.S. They tend to be male. They tend to be somewhat younger. They might be graduate students. And they emphasize professional-type reasons for taking a MOOC. They seem to be serious about the MOOC. They seem to be very eager for the knowledge and skills that it can provide them, because they really want those to help them in their further career, right? And those are the ones we're calling strivers here. The other population are the grazers, right? And these are folks who tend to live within the U.S. They have strong English skills, mostly native speakers. They tend to be a little bit older. They're more likely to be female, and they emphasize enjoyment reasons, right? So they're there for their interest in the subject matter of the MOOCs. There are even some indications, although they didn't come out very clearly in the multivariate analysis, which we'll show you soon, that the strivers actually do better in the MOOCs in terms of their overall performance, which you kind of expect, right? Because they're sort of trying hard. They have strong reasons to do well. But I think they have corresponding disadvantages, because many of them are outside the U.S., which we'll see soon. I think that's the end of this little section on the student analysis. Do we have time to take one or two questions on this? Yeah, why don't we take a question or two on this stuff? That was a bunch of data there. There's one over here. Here you go.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could speak to your response rates, your end for your surveys.
I have those somewhere. The response rate on the pre-survey was actually pretty good. I want to say it was
around 23. Is that right?
Yeah, I want to say it was 25 to 35%, depending on the MOOC, which is pretty good. God, fuck it. And I don't know what the response rate was for the post-survey. It was worse. It depends on. It depends on how you measure completion. So. That we don't know, because we didn't measure it in terms of videos watched, but we did measure it in terms of number of assignments completed. Like, for one thing, did they complete any assignment at all? Did they complete 50% of the assignments? Did they have a non-zero score on all the assignments? I think there are many ways of measuring completion. We didn't go the Coursera route and look at activity, because I think other folks have done that. So we did it more in terms of self-reports and performance on graded assignments. So I'll get the response rates for you soon. Anything else at this point? Okay, I'll hand it over to Christopher.
Well, that question is actually a nice segue to this portion, because when we started off this, we were very aware of the fact that low completion rates or low success rates were something that were plaguing the concept of MOOCs writ large. And we were beginning to see conversations in the ether and in some public forum about how maybe, you know, simply full completion and that sort of thing maybe isn't the best benchmark for those things, that there might be multiple ways of thinking about what constitutes success here. And so we approached this from the notion that there might be a supply side as well as a demand side of the curve in terms of how completion or success might actually be defined. So for the most part, we had seen the supply side sort of created, how Coursera was defining it based on number of clicks, number of videos watched, number of assignments completed, and so forth, or even by the instructors, by the points awarded and the grades. But there's also that demand side of the curve coming from the students. I could very well imagine there being a student who really only wants to get one section out of an entire MOOC because that's what they're really interested in. And for them, that would be success relative to other things. So very early on, we were in the planning stages of thinking about this and thinking about doing sort of these cross-model comparisons of what the impact might be and how these things might play out. So for intent on the baseline survey, we asked folks how much they intended to complete, and I think it was all of the thing, basically every aspect and every assignment, everything but assignments, and then only part.
Only certain parts.
And that was the basis for intent. And that's the first model that we're going to run here. For the self-reported, we asked them on the back end how much they completed relative to what they intended to complete. And that was more than they intended to, about the same as, or less than they had intended. And then we did have completion rates on a whole variety of different assignments built in there. For this particular purpose, we just selected sort of the 50% mark as a way of showing a watershed for completion. But it's not whether or not they made it halfway through the course. It's whether or not they completed 50% of all of the assignments spread throughout. And then Walker will talk about the total points, which is basically just the cumulative points on the back end of things. So for the first model, what we ended up observing was that the reasons for enrolling all were significant and positive predictors for intent. The folks who responded to our surveys were obviously thinking to themselves, yes, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do all of it, and this is going to be really great, and this is going to be a lot of fun. And so regardless of the reason for doing it that Walker just walked you through, they were pretty keen on that idea. We also saw folks that who were more proficient in English claiming that they intended to complete all of the course a little bit more than they said that they would complete just parts of it. I think the flip side of that is probably more interesting and might speak more to those who aren't as fluent in English and might just be a little concerned that they might not be able to complete the whole thing. And so they're kind of hedging their bets on the front end and saying, you know, maybe I'd like to complete the whole thing, but I'm not really going to probably be able to. Negatively, we had age correlated with this, so the younger folks were the ones that were sort of really keen on completing the entire MOOC, while older folks were probably more into this grazer category, and I think this kind of confirms what Walker was just talking about. And location, being in the United States versus not being in the United States, and whether one was a male or female didn't matter in terms of predicting intent. And there's a huge blank strip there along the bottom for the obstacles to completion, and that's because those are post-test variables, so you can't really use post-test variables to predict the baseline variable, so we didn't add those to the comparative models. But we did add them to when we looked at the self-reported outcomes. Here we see that the professional access and enjoyment reasons kind of zero out. There's really no statistically significant effect there on predicting the self-reported completion, but doing it for university reasons still remains strong there and still predicted in a significant and positive direction that they completed more than they had actually intended to. Here we see that location inside the United States actually mattered in terms of the self-reporting, as well as having connection problems. And we've tried to figure out what that might actually mean, but we're not really sure like how having connection problems leads you to completing more than you intended to. But these are the numbers, and maybe some of you have some good ideas of how to interpret that. This time we see the English proficiency going negative in terms of predicting the self-reported. And I think this plays into Walker's description of the strivers, right? The people outside of the United States that are perhaps less fluent in English are the ones who really sort of completed more than they thought they were going to, and that those who were English fluent really didn't complete as much as they thought that they would. And so we get kind of a flip scale on that one. And pretty much everything else just kind of was non-significant predictors. We didn't see much in the way of obstacles to completion being self-reported there or having an impact on the self-reporting. We also used the original intent variable as a control. You can see that at the bottom there to predict the self-reported. So using what each individual said they were initially going to do and trying to use that to predict what they self-reported. And that kind of zeroes out on the end, which basically tells us that people completed about as much as they said they were going to from the get-go. So maybe they wanted to complete all, and they did. Maybe they wanted to complete just a little bit of it, and they did that as well. When we look at the 50% completion, again, the university reasons holds out as being a significant and positive predictor here, while the others are still uncorrelated, remain uncorrelated to that. And intent, for the first time, actually predicts completing about 50% of the course there. The negative ones here become really interesting, I think, because we see now that location outside of the United States, that those people that Walker was categorizing as strivers, people living outside the U.S., are now predicted to complete at least 50% of the course materials in the MOOC, while those that are inside do not. Younger folks are completing more, and here's where we really begin to see the obstacles playing themselves out in some meaningful ways, that work and family issues seem to be very strong obstacles that reduce the probability that people are going to complete at least 50% of the coursework. And if we think about this, I mean, if one is paying tuition and going to a university for credit and so forth and is engaged in a curriculum, that's going to have a much higher priority than something that you're doing for fun on the side for free. And so when you know, the kids get sick or something, a new project happens at work, the first thing that's going to go is the thing that you're doing on the side that doesn't really sort of have any value for the long term. And I think we're seeing that reflected in that data point. So Walker's going to talk about the total points and then sort of lead us out at the end of the presentation.
Let's see. Okay, and here are the variables that just did not predict significantly one way or another, whether or not a student completed 50% of the assignments or not. The last column represents an ordinary least squares model attempting to predict aggregate total points in each of the MOOCs on the basis of pre- and post-test data. And you can see the positive predictors there. English proficiency is predicting, which surprises me a little bit. I mean, it doesn't surprise me very much that intent to complete a lot of the MOOC, nor self-reported having completed a lot of the MOOC, predict aggregate points, because aggregate points, I mean, if you complete a lot of assignments, you're going to pile up a lot of points, right? So it's probably going to predict positively. The negative predictors here, so sex is a negative predictor. Given the way it was coded, that means women are doing slightly better in terms of total points than men are. And we can see a few in the obstacles to completion category, we can see a few problems cropping up here that are actually, that they may not have prevented students from completing the MOOC or getting to the 50% mark, but they are impeding their actual performance. And interestingly, we have a separate analysis conducted by another colleague at Minnesota of the international students who took our MOOCs. And one thing we found was that they have a lot more problems than students in the U.S. Of all sorts. They even have more like family and work problems, which is interesting because we have family and work here, and those are sometimes obstacles. Anyway, but these are clearly obstacles to performance. And these are the negative. These are the null predictors. You can see the university type reasons drop out of significance here. It's worth noting perhaps at this point that we've run these models, but they're not actually very good. If you know anything about multivariate modeling and we tell you that the R squared on these things is really low, like the best adjusted R squared was for the last model and it's like 0.37 or so or something like that, not real strong. So that means we're predicting 37% of the variability in the outcome and the other models predicted even less. These models are jumping around a lot. So I think as we continue our research on MOOCs, the models will become more solid. Part of what may be going on is that we don't have the right variables necessary to predict student performance in these MOOCs. And that may be a function of the fact that this is a very different population. Another way of looking at the data here is looking across rows, and then you can look at the effect of different predictor variables across the different models that we're using. And you can see university-related reasons, strangely enough, predict a lot of stuff about these MOOCs, which is weird because we wouldn't have thought anybody would have heard of the University of Minnesota or the professors teaching these MOOCs. We thought people just pick, you know, from a list of courses in Coursera. English proficiency is doing some work, as is the intent to complete. Younger people are doing better by some measures of completion, and family and work issues are a problem for a couple of different measures. And these are the null predictors. We do want to get to questions, but I want to foreshadow another branch of our MOOC research, which we're not going to tell you about. We'll just kind of give you a teaser slide here. Learning is really hard to measure in a MOOC in an interesting and valid way, and I think that's for two reasons. One is that you don't know where students are starting off. You don't have a measure of their baseline knowledge or their skill. So even if you can measure their skills and knowledge at the end of your MOOC, you don't know where they started. And for all you know, they could have started in that same place and they've learned nothing, right? So you have no baseline measure, nor do you typically have a comparison, right? So you don't typically have a valid comparison against which you can compare the outcomes of your MOOC students so that you know whether the MOOC is more or less effective than some other medium, right? What we've tried to do in this MOOC, which is has to do with recommender systems in computer science, this was taught in fall 2013 with a computer science professor at Minnesota. We've tried to overcome those two problems. So Professor Conson actually ran a MOOC version of his course side by side, simultaneously with a face-to-face version or a hybrid version. So the face-to-face students had access to the MOOC materials and were in fact required to use them. And then we had the normal cohort of MOOC students coming from all over the world using the MOOC materials. They took the same assessments, they had the same course materials and subject matter and so forth. So that helps us with the comparison part. We also designed, or he designed, a pre and post course knowledge test, which we administered to students at the beginning and at the end of the course. So that helps us with not knowing where students start off, because now we do know where they start off. We know what their baseline knowledge level is. Those are our results, as you can see right there. Students do learn in a MOOC, or they can anyway, lots of them do. I don't think anybody knew that before. And all sorts of different students learn in a MOOC. The learning gains were evenly distributed over demographic categories and levels of knowledge, so that's good. It doesn't advantage some students more than others. But the face-to-face component does help. So if there are any faculty members out there, you are doing your students some good by teaching them face-to-face in addition to having all that online stuff. We're going to present this at the Association for Computing Machinery Conference, the Learning at Scale Conference, coming up in about a month. And that is about the end of things, so we can now take questions. Have we beaten you to death with our tables full of data? That happens sometimes. Here you go.
Can you tell me, the results that you've been talking about today, is that been published or is it being sent out for a journal publication?
We haven't talked about that yet.
No, not yet.
But we should.
But
we should.
I mean, there's very little literature out there, so that'd be fantastic to have.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's mostly descriptive and predictive data. It's not experimental. I think both Christopher and I are kind of hypothesis testing sort of guys, and so. But thank you. We may well publish it.
You mentioned that these are a very different population of students. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? I mean, we've looked at some of the different demographic variables, but are you saying that these are much different than our traditional campus students, or do they fit more into like the continuing ed type student?
They may fit more with the continuing ed type student. So especially the students not in the U.S. tend to be older. They're much more likely to be male. They have higher educational levels starting off. English proficiency not as good as U.S. students. Anything else?
Well, it was kind of skewed towards being more highly educated as well, which is something that I think we were kind of seeing over and over for other folks that are doing demographic analyses as well. So lots of folks with PhDs or experience in the field already. Some of the ones that were doing it for professional reasons were doing it as sort of a continuing ed thing. So they were already working in the field and just kind of trying to bone up on this narrow dimension of something else.
So we asked students a lot of questions about their academic level and their whether they were professionals in this field or another field. We had a lot of people in the same field. These were science-y MOOCs, right? So there was one in veterinary medicine, one was epidemiology, another was this really advanced chemistry course. So there's a lot of folks taking those with the hope of advancing their careers. What else? Yeah. Maybe I can just encourage you to grab that mic.
If the more interactivity is in the MOOC built in, is it so that did you look at the my English is now coming to me? Do students finish the MOOC if there's more interactivity inside the MOOC? Did you measure that?
That's a good question. I don't know that we did.
It is a good question, and I would probably guess that if that was the case, that it probably would be, because I think we know that more interaction and engagement tends to produce higher learning gains. Although I don't know that there was much in the way of variability in terms of that kind of thing within the MOOCs themselves. I think it was mostly your standard format of recorded lectures and PowerPoints and so forth put up for students to consume that way. So it wasn't what I think some people call the CMOOC, is that what it's called?
The Connectivist MOOC.
The Connectivist MOOC. Mm-hmm. These were not of that particular model. Yeah.
Well, one thing we do know, we ask students for self-ratings of the importance of various features of the MOOC to their learning. Right? So which of these, you know, variety of stuff in the MOOC helped you to learn? And there was a clear division between stuff that was content-related, right? So video lectures and stuff like that, and then stuff that was interactive, right? So interacting with my peers, peer rating, talking to professors and TAs, and the stuff that was interactive was rated far lower than the stuff that was content-related. So, I don't know.
And the pattern that actually was there is the same that we saw in some of the meta-analyses done by Bernard and company, right? Where it's student content and student-student interactions that are the most valuable things in online learning scenarios, and the instructor-student relationships tend to predict a little bit less, or to be a little bit less important to student learning that way. Mm-hmm. And I think we saw that in our MOOCs.
So I told you I'd come here to heckle you a little bit. So this is sort of feels like a dissertation defense kind of question, but I guess I'm wondering the kind of so what? I mean, if you're the University of Minnesota decision makers on this, what do you make of this? Is this consistent with the mission of the university? I mean, if you've got all these folks outside the university, these drivers that are taking this for professional reasons, is that good or bad or what?
I think I see our job as that of providing data to the decision makers, right? Oh, which they can act on as they see fit. And so part of what we wanted to do was say, look, these are the populations you're serving, right? If serving those populations is consistent with the mission of a public research university, say outreach and so forth, then terrific, right? Then keep doing it. On the other hand, maybe you don't want to serve a bunch of grazers in the U.S. and strivers in countries around the world, right? Maybe that's not of interest. So I guess I don't know really. I mean, it's up to the provost and folks of that nature to say. Do you want to jump in?
No, I think you hit on exactly what I would have said. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how massiveness impacted things? Like, did you see, like, if there were a whole lot of people involved, did it make a difference in any way?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that we controlled for size in any of the models. I mean, they're all sort of big enough that at a certain point you're going to either get something or you're not going to get something in terms of the results. Do you recall anything with the comparing of the size across?
I mean, the MOOCs did differ in size, but I think probably not. I mean, from a student's point of view, I think it was just all a boatload of students. Right? So once you get above some threshold number, it just seems like many. So as far as that goes, I think it didn't make a difference. I mean, the massiveness does, of course, reduce the degree to which a professor can interact meaningfully with students and things like that.
Just how massive were these five courses?
We had a total nominal enrollment for all five courses of around 71,000, so that's something like that, distributed somewhat unevenly between the courses. So that's the maximum number, as I said at the beginning. That's people going into Coursera and clicking a button saying, ooh, gee, veterinary medicine, maybe I'll study that. And by the way, just as a follow-up, the end on our pre-survey was 21,000 and change with a response rate of about 30%. And the end on our post-survey was about 2,800, response rate of nearly 14%. So, it's not the greatest response rate, but if you do survey research, you know that anything around 15% or above is looking pretty good these days.
And not only that comparison, but dealing with a phenomenon where really there is no obligation on the part of those who are doing it. It's entirely goodwill. So in many ways, the 14% is actually pretty good, I think.
Well, we are drawing near the end of our time. Is there perhaps one more question?
I don't have a question. I have a theory about the connectivity people. Think of it as Netflix and binge watching. I have Saturday to download all the videos, and I have an hour to upload my assignment, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Could be, right? Maybe because a lot of these MOOCs were self-scheduled, and students can complete them at whatever pace they choose and so forth. Yeah, so that may be the pattern. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.